The Thomistic Institute's Aquinas 101 program is bringing the truth of the Catholic faith to millions every year, but it's only possible because of support from listeners like you. Aquinas 101 is entirely audience-funded. Each episode exists thanks to your generosity. Will you help make the next one possible with a small gift? Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/donate to learn more. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/donate.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So, yes, thank you very much for inviting me, and the topic of free will is certainly one that concerns whether we are still human and what we think about free will as one of the particular dignities that we have as human beings being made in the image and likeness of God. And it is interesting, if you take a step back, that our culture is rather schizophrenic about that question, as about many other things, once you have to come to reflect a little bit on that. And in some way, we very much believe in free will, and in other ways, not at all. I'm going to talk mostly about the not at all part today. But just to preface that a little bit and put it in perspective, just the ways in which we do believe in free will as a matter of culture. So we all think that choice is a very important thing for us. Must be our choice. We must be autonomous. Nobody is going to dictate to us what we're supposed to do, believe, or think. And, I mean, give me liberty or give me death, basically. You know, that's the idea for a long time, and has led to an idea where we are almost crafting ourselves and our identities. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre thought about these things in these terms already. But now we do it technically, surgically, and with medication and all sorts of things. And we'll talk about transhumanism later on, too. So we are at a stage where we think we can make ourselves into whatever we want. And then the question arises, what do we want? Is choice really the most important thing to have? Is free will an end in itself? And I just found it. It's just took that from the friar's basement. The first things, I hope you know that. Good publication to read. So Rusty Reno quotes Gen Z writer from a Substack. And here's what it says. It doesn't work either. Just to quote a part of that. I think we underestimate how hard it is for young people today to feel their way through life without moral guardrails and guidance, to follow the whims and wishes of our ego, and be affirmed by adults every step of the way. I'm not sure that's actual freedom. And if it is, I'm not sure freedom is what any of us actually wants. Freedom has become a burden, in a way, and why might that be? Well, because freedom or free will is not an end in itself, it is a means to an end. And what might that end be? What do we choose everything for? We always choose something for the sake of a good. And the sum total of all the goods, the ultimate good that we all want, is happiness. Nobody intentionally wants to be unhappy. Now, there may be strange people who, you know, take some delight in, you know, making themselves miserable or something like that. But then that's their happiness. You know, they find some good in that in any case. You can never choose an evil or bad thing for its own sake. And so free will has a goal, a telos, a purpose, an end that it wants to achieve, and that is happiness. And that makes it intelligible that there are some analogies even from the natural world. So if I let this go, how do we call that? Free fall, right? Free fall. Now, why would we call that free? because it can achieve its purpose, its goal, its telos. I mean, if it had subjective states, it would be happy because it would arrive where it wants to be, right? Which for Aristotle and Aquinas is the center of gravity. Now, we also have a center of gravity that makes us happy, and that is God. So, as you know famously, St. Augustine says, restless are our hearts until they rest in thee, O God. Right? That's our center of gravity. And just as the stone would rest in the center of gravity, so our hearts will rest in God. That's our natural goal and end, and that's what's going to make us happy. And our love makes us gravitate towards God, St. Augustine says. Amor meus, pondus meus. My love is my weight, he says. Gravity. And so this is just to see, to put it a bit in perspective, I'll come back to that a little later. But free will, first of all, is not an end in itself, and it has its own kind of goal by which it is measured. Free will is a power, and all powers are measured by their goals and ends and purposes. It's not a very powerful faculty if it cannot achieve what it wants. And we want to be happy, and we will be ultimately happy with God. So that's the side, though, that emphasizes free will. For free will, and here I said it's a means for an end, and that is happiness. So it is politically correct, if you want, to believe in choice. It is also very much politically correct to believe in science, when it fits our agenda. And that is usually to beat up those right-wing religious people or something like that, you know, as bigoted and behind the times. Which was never true, by the way, but it's a long-standing mantra in history. But in any case, with that, you can also beat up on free will. And so people do both. You know, in culture, they believe they have free choice, and that's a very important thing. And then they look at a brain scan and suddenly think that everything is determined. And only religious people believe in free will. Cannot have it both ways, but they're trying. And I think part of us, it's all of our system in some way, we're part of the culture too. And there's one particular experiment that emphasized that, and just generally, you know, if people show brain scans, you know, the audience stops thinking. I hope you don't show brain scan later. But in any case, you can get too close to the matter of the brain and not see exactly what's going on anymore. And I will try to show you that in the rest of the talk, what is going on. This experiment was done by Benjamin Libet. In 1985. And it's not that complicated. I mean, it has been replicated and with variations and other things over time. But it's basically you put somebody in a laboratory setting and says, now you wiggle your finger within the next 30 seconds, but without planning ahead, without thinking ahead. And when you do that, you just also notice this, the dial on this watch, on this clock, on this timer. And so that we can measure, you know, when you felt first the urge or the wish to act. So that to observe themselves for the point when they were first aware of the wish or urge to act and then press a button. And then the timer will measure that. At the same time, the brain activity is going to be scanned and measured. And so what did they find? They found that the brain already does something before that person in the experiment was aware of that urge to act, right? So the brain, in some way, had already made the decision before the actual conscious choice, which of course suggests, you know, the brain made me do it or whatever else. It's not my conscious choice. I'm just confabulating that I have free will and do these acts freely and consciously. But in fact, there's some other causal processes in the brain and elsewhere that make me really do it before I'm even aware of that. Now, I know that from UC Berkeley, I mean, we're teaching next door to UC Berkeley, the undergraduates that take the typical classes and they get presented with that experiment and they immediately lose their belief in free will. Do we need to lose our belief in free will? I don't think so, and I'm going to show you why. But first of all, just more general observations. I mean, one is, people also made studies that when people lose their belief in free will after watching this kind of experiment, for example, they will also start to cheat more on tests. It's not my fault after all, you know, it's the brain made me do it. But others say, well, it may also make us more compassionate. You know, this criminal couldn't really help it. So it's, should I say, every criminal in some way is actually a victim, you know, of his brain. Of course, you can also turn that around and say, well, every victim also is a potential criminal, right? And so everybody is suspect. And you may want to institute, you know, brain scans at airports or high school doors or things like that, you know, to make sure that nobody is doing anything evil there. Or you eliminate them, take them out before that, you know, the Minority Report, that movie, you know, where they do exactly that. So that's some general observation. Other observations have to do with the results are actually not as striking as they seem. These brain scans are actually not that reliable. I mean, you have to go to the skull and all of that. And so people have said that what they measure, this what they call readiness potential, what is spiking in the brain before you become conscious of it, is only 60% accurate. So that's just slightly more than chance and could be just, you know, a propensity that you may also resist. And in fact, Benjamin Libet did suggest that maybe we don't have free will, but we have free won't. That is, we can still veto perhaps this readiness potential. It has its own problems because in order to veto that, do you need another readiness potential, basically, you know, and how would that end up? So that is then, in this case, not so striking. Another thing to observe is that there are a lot of hasty generalizations going on here. There are various types of actions that are possible, and they lump all of that together under this particular scenario, which is rather artificial. So people look at artificial settings, like this experiment, and then very often also pathological cases. So people with brain damage, for example. And then you see what they do, and they think they did it, but we know the brain did it, and then they confabulate that actually it was them who did it. Or you have schizophrenics that project their own activity into other things, and maybe that's what we always do with our free will. Certain kinds of automaticity is, you know, like a knee-jerk reflex, you know. Your leg just goes up. I mean, you don't think, you don't make a choice there. And they would say, well, maybe all of our actions like that. It's just in some cases we project and confabulate that we actually consciously chose to do this. And so there's something in our body that basically takes over. You may know Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. You know, the one who is always hanging on his arm because he wants to make the Nazi salute, you know, all of that. Well, our free will would be something like that, you know, this kind of alien hand syndrome that does something out of our own body. And that's sort of the paradigm for free will. Well, really? I mean, is that how we experience free will? As if something else happens to us or that comes as a surprise or something of that sort? These are all very strange cases, and to make that the normative case for what all free will looks like is a very strange generalization. Now, that's just by way of preliminary kind of observations. But you can take this last case and to get to a more serious point. If all of our thoughts and all of our free actions are just induced false beliefs, confabulations, and so forth of that sort, then the very theories themselves must also be a case of confabulation or pathology. And in fact, you do find people talking that way. And the problem here is that the very science that claims such determinism and denies free will must, in fact, claim it to be true. That's, first of all, what I'm trying to show. Let's make that my first point here. Science needs free will. So there are, I found in one book, people saying that when we look at the brain, there is no distinction between conscious action, reflex, and disease. So whatever behavior we look at, when we look at the brain, it all looks the same, whether it's conscious action, mere reflex, or just pathological. But that means you could also put the scanner at the brain of the neuroscientist, and it also looks indistinguishable from reflex and disease. Right? How is your neuroscience not a case of just that kind of pathology or reflex? And if so, what reason do we have to believe that it is true? So the question of truth is, you cannot decide by looking at your nervous system or in your neurons. And if you have a false belief and you have a true belief, in either case, something is going to fire in your brain. Right? There's always something going on in the brain, but looking at the brain doesn't tell you whether your belief is true or false, right? To give you an example that may even come in this afternoon again, it's from Edmund Husserl. So he says, if you have a calculation machine, today we think of a computer, calculator, and let's say you have two machines, and one is spitting out 2 plus 2 is 4, and the other one gives you always 2 plus 2 is 5. Right? So one, we would say, is right, and the other is wrong. But based on what? On the laws of electromechanics? No. They are not broken in the machines. Both machines operate on the laws of electromechanics, right? These are the causalities that happen in nature. Just as they would happen in the brain, you can observe those causalities as well. But in either case, there's something going on, and there's nothing wrong with the laws of nature. They're just laws of nature. They are as they are, and they cannot be otherwise. They cannot be broken. But there are some laws that can be broken, such as the laws of mathematics or logic. And we can distinguish between two types of laws. It's important. So there are descriptive laws, like the laws of nature, that just describe how things operate always and everywhere. And there are prescriptive laws, and these can be broken. So you can miscalculate, you can break the laws of mathematics, you can break traffic laws, you know, canon law. These are all laws you can break, you know, grammar.
And so descriptive laws and prescriptive. Descriptive laws are about, I would say, causes, to make a terminological distinction here. And prescriptive would be about reasons. So our reasons for why we think certain things are true or false, why we think that 2 plus 2 is 4 and not 5, that depends on the laws of mathematics, not on the laws of electromechanics. These are the laws by which we evaluate the operations of the machines. And so similarly, we should do the same with things in our brain. They operate on certain physiological laws and so forth and so on, but they don't tell us whether they're true or false. That depends on logic. So I have to look logically at the argument of the neuroscientist whether what he or she says could possibly be right or true. And so, and this would be then making an argument. Now, here's the important point, and it's a point that C.S. Lewis made. In order to make an argument, you have to be free. Right? So you have to be free to follow where the premises lead you. That is, to
go from the premises to conclusion, that's a law that's following the prescriptive laws of logic, not the descriptive laws of nature. The descriptive laws of nature can get in the way, right? You may want to think from, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, and then you want to conclude Socrates is mortal, but then your brain is getting in the way, right? And tells us to say something else totally, Socrates is an ape or something like that, you know? Well, that doesn't follow logically, but it may, in this case, follow from the from your brain if you are not free. You have to be able to follow the laws of logic without interference of the descriptive laws of nature. You have to be free from them to do that. Otherwise, there is no reason, literally, to believe what you say is true. So a neuroscientist would be just dragged along pathologically or by reflex to make his or her statements about brain determinism, but there is no basis for that to think that it is true, and that the outcome is basically random. So you cannot derive validity, a rational conclusion, from something irrational and random. And again, you must be free to follow the laws of logic and a rational argument to make your point. So the very science, again, that claims determinism would undermine itself in doing so. So if you say this, that science proves the non-existence of freedom, then that's a form of self-contradiction. That is just not possible. Now, this is about the truth of this claim, but there is also a problem with the very meaning of this claim. And I'm talking not about the meaning of freedom here, but the contrary claim. So if I say, we are all determined. What do I mean by determinism? Only a philosopher will ask these kind of questions. You know, we think that's all self-evident. But if you find, if you try to define that, you will find that this is a derivative term. Determined would be not to have alternative possibilities. So you have, you deny possibilities. Right? So if you define something by denying something, that which you negate, you have to presuppose. You have to already know what that is. You have to know what possibility means before you can define determinism. But in other words, you have to have a sense of possibilities and of the freedom that comes with that in order to have a meaningful sense of what determinism is. And this is, get that from my own professor, you mentioned Robert Spemann, and I think he gets it from Henri Bergson, so that other people have made that point. So in some way, you need to have an experience of freedom and possibility in order to have a meaningful sense of what determinism would be. Right? If you're not free, you also don't have a sense of what determinism is. And this point, you can enlarge a little bit. So determinism is sort of a particular kind of thing that we state based on a larger realm of possibilities in which we always already live. In this larger realm, it has been called the life world, the ordinary kind of world in which we live and in which also the scientist lives. So we have the scientist as a family, perhaps, and then morning, you know, goes and drives to the laboratory, enters the laboratory, closes the door, and then makes his experiments, perhaps with rats or something like that, run a labyrinth. But then in the evening, he closes that door and goes back home into the larger world in which he lives. And he doesn't look at his family like the rats in the laboratory, typically, right? That's the larger kind of field, which gives him the motivation to do science in the first place, maybe to develop medication for his family or something like that, and which is in some way the more meaningful and fundamental point of reference for all his ideas and terms and so forth. So he may in the laboratory develop scientific theories that are deterministic, but in his life world, he makes all these choices and has his motivations for doing this science in the first place. So
that does be the life world. Then here is the laboratory. And that L, you can also, let's stand for Benjamin Libet, right?
So the experiments that we make, including Benjamin Libet, begin in a realm that is not covered by the experience, by the experiment. It's a wider kind of field. And the way that plays out is this. It is in the life world that you decide, well, that's an act of free will, that you decide to enter the laboratory and to participate in the experiment. That is where your true free choice happens. That's all over already before you enter into the laboratory. So, which gives you first inkling that maybe what you're looking at in this experiment is not free will. It has already happened elsewhere. So by free choice, you enter the experiment. Now, if you didn't do it by free choice, you would have a problem with the experiment itself. Because what do? You decide to enter the experiment if you promise the experimenter to truthfully report what happens in the experiment. You make a commitment to cooperate with the rules. These are rules that are prescriptive, rules that you can break, right? So you make a promise to follow these rules despite of where your brain may lead you, basically, right? If the brain makes all these choices already for you, you have no business making promises, right? A promise presupposes freedom. To promise to do something in the future, and promises we can break, so on the prescriptive rules. Promises is for something in the future, how can we guarantee that we are going to do that if we don't have the free will to follow through on our commitments? John Searle, a Berkeley philosopher, said that a promise is to create desire-independent reasons for action. Desire-independent freedoms for action. So if I promise to you to do A or B tomorrow, then it doesn't matter how I feel or what desires I have tomorrow. By my free will, I'm going to do it, period. That's what the commitment is. Otherwise, the promise makes no sense. And people have noticed that to promise has to do with reason and free will. So Friedrich Nietzsche, for example, says that man is the animal that can make promises. And promises presuppose free will. And this promise is something presupposed to enter into the laboratory. And it has already happened before you even enter the setting. Now, here's where that becomes then even more relevant. If you say, I have a set of data from Benjamin Libet's experiment, and they show that we don't have free will, what does that do to the data? It makes the data unreliable, because you cannot follow through on truth, promising to truthfully report, right? So if the data show that you are determined, then the data are not reliable, and then they don't show that you are determined, right? So there's a self-undermining kind of idea here. So in principle, these kind of experiments cannot show that you are determined. So that's the second point. The third point, actually, this was the second and third point. let me continue then with the third point. Now, this is the next question is, are you looking in the right place? In some way, that was already the case here. You're not. But I mean here that what do we understand by free will? If you don't know what free will is, then you don't know where to look for it. And you don't know whether you have found it when you see it or not. Right? So you have to have the right idea of free will, the right concept of free will. And if you then look at this experiment and see how it is described or prescribed, you find phrases like you are to notice when you experience the urge to act. Now, is that free will? I mean, first of all, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have these readiness potentials in the brain, and then you just wait for the readiness potential to tell you when to wiggle your finger, basically, right? So that's Raymond Tellis says, the experiment treats individuals as passive respondents to stimuli and then discovers that they are passive respondents to stimuli. So self-fulfilling prophecy, this is not surprising, really. But notice this is a passive formulation. You experience something. You wait for something to happen to you. Something arises in you, which is not, well, what? Not your choice in a way. We become passive bystanders and observers of an experience, not the doers or enactors of an intention. And there have been other experiences like that before, and it's not so surprising then. So you can poke your brain and somebody lifts his arm, but typically people will notice, tell the experimenter, you did that, not I, right? So free will is not something that happens to you, it is something you do. Free will is also, otherwise it becomes like a sneeze or vomit, you know, that's not a paradigm for free will. It's also not a feeling, like an urge or something of that sort. To act freely may not feel like anything. In fact, you can act in the face of a lot of contrary feelings. It's what we call a temptation, right? So you may feel not doing these things and you do it anyway. That's what free will is. Free will is not a feeling. And if you look for that as a feeling, well, then you'll get all these brain things because feelings have physiological basis, right? It's not surprising that you will find that. But that is not what free will is. That is rather what could be an obstacle to free will, not the paradigm of it. It's like a temptation. And then it leaves out a very important part of free will to begin with, which is rational deliberation. So Aristotle will talk about free will as the rational appetite. Immanuel Kant talks about practical reason, rationality, and then Thomas Aquinas would agree, even though he says it's also an extra faculty, but it presupposes a rational choice. And the way to see that is if I give you two envelopes and put them in front of you on a desk, and I tell you one contains a $1 million check for you, and the other contains your death sentence. Now choose. So you choose one envelope, and lo and behold, it's your death sentence. What are you going to say? I didn't want that. Well, yes, you did. You chose it. Nobody forced you to take that envelope, right? Yeah, but I didn't know what I was doing, right? It's not an informed choice. It's not based on rational deliberation. And for us, what we mean by free will has to do with knowing what we do and what we choose. Now, if you take that and then you look back at this experiment, what does it tell you? You are asked to wiggle your finger without planning ahead. It's an explicit stipulation in that experiment that you should not plan ahead without thinking, which means the experiment purposely, by definition and instruction, eliminates a necessary condition for free choice and then pretends to say something about free choice. So this, in so many ways, does not make a lot of sense. The real choice has already happened way before that, as I said, in the life world, before you enter the experiment, the choice to enter the experiment. Now, what gives this an interest is that some of our choices are indeed of that sort. How did you get out of bed this morning? You probably set your alarm clock, right? So then the alarm clock went, and maybe you hit the snooze button, right? But you chose, perhaps, to say, now I have to get up. I mean, you could also just remain in bed and say, forget about this first talk. Or you choose to get up. But you may stay a little longer in bed, you know? And then at a certain point, you find yourself outside of bed. How did that happen, right? This particular point in time, you didn't quite choose. There's an overarching governing kind of choice that you make, but the point in time in which you do that, you left to what? Maybe your readiness potentials, right, in the brain, or when your physiology is ready, you know, and your blood starts circulating enough, then your body knows when it's time to go up. You leave it to your body to make that decision, but it's your free will that chooses the readiness potentials, your body, your physiology, as a tool of its free choice. It's not contrary to your free choice. It becomes an expression of your free choice. And that is something we do all the time. If you play tennis, if you decide how to move your hand, or if you play the piano, where to put your finger in each particular case, you will never play very well, right? You have to habituate yourself, and then you can allow your body to make these choices for you in a particular situation. But it doesn't mean that you play tennis or piano involuntarily. That actually was impossible, right? So again, you must not look too closely, which is often what you do when you're looking at the brain, if you want to understand what free will is. There's a brain element in it. The brain is not the organ of free choice, but there may be some things happening there for such reasons, you know. So, and that is indeed what people found in further experiments on the brain. So you can say there is a readiness potential, and then you wiggle your finger or something like that. One thing follows another. But as a philosopher will know, that doesn't necessarily mean that causality is at work here. Night always follows day, but that doesn't mean that day causes night to come about, right? And in this case, too, there's still a question that it always comes before that. Does that mean that it causes my choice, or is something else going on? And so in 2010, Aaron Schurger from the National Institute of Health and Medical Research in Paris made further experiments and came to the conclusion that indeed there are these readiness potentials in the brain, and they're like spontaneous fluctuations that you have there. They arise like meteorological phenomena or changes in the stock market or something of that sort. But they don't intrinsically have anything to do with your free choices, but you may avail yourself of these things in order to decide in situations where there is nothing much to decide about. So, for example, when you get out of bed, for example, right? Or you are going to the supermarket and you want to buy peanut butter. Right? You have a whole shelf full of peanut butter jars. Which one are you going to choose? Well, there's not much to deliberate about, right? They're all alike. In this case, well, you just let your body take over, or your readiness potentials. And that, if you then say, well, this was my free choice, that's not just a confabulation. It was. Because we allowed ourselves freely to be determined by other things because there wasn't much else to decide on. That is itself rational, and it is a rational choice. And so there is a place for that, but the real choice has happened in a much larger picture. Now, I'm already running out of time, and there's so much more to say. Let me just see what I'm saying. So I wanted to come to Thomas Aquinas, of course. And if you look at Thomas Aquinas and what he says about free will, it is, first of all, very commonsensical. You know, so yes, we have free will in all the ways that I just said, but it's not unlimited. It's not like, you know, we create ourselves or, you know, decide everything else for us. There's a limited realm in which we act freely, and not even in our own nature. Are we still human is the question. In our human nature, not everything is subject to free will. For example, your heartbeat. You know, maybe some gurus in India can control that by free will. But normally, our vegetative system is not part of what we control by free will, or our digestion. You know, sometimes that may be good if you could, but we can't. You know? So other things, our emotions are not simply under our control. We can sort of persuade our emotions. We can talk back to our emotions. We can avoid temptations. Mm-hmm. Because we have, by free will, the ability to walk out of the room and avoid them. You know? But once we're in the face of it and we cannot help it, there are certain things that are going to happen to us and we cannot switch it off by an act of free will. And so there are a number of things in that way. There are also laws of nature operative in us. Now, this is not something Aquinas talks a lot about, because this whole idea of laws of nature that is so familiar to us really came into the forefront only in the 17th century. That was not part of the science that people knew at Thomas Aquinas' age. So he didn't have the question, are the laws of physics that determine us and that make us do what we do and that underlie even our brain physiology and so forth and so on. But there is a curious analog in Thomas Aquinas for these laws of nature. And it may sound strange, but it's actually a pretty precise analog. And this is the motion of the stars. I mean, even today we think we can calculate the motion of the planets and Kepler's laws and things like that. So they operate with mathematical, geometrical kind of regularity that we also would think of as in laws of nature and physics and so forth. That the Middle Ages also thought. Whereas here on Earth they thought that's all a bit more imprecise, basically. Nevertheless, they do have an influence on us. And that's what sort of sounds like astrology, right? So the stars affect us in some way. And depending on where you're born, you know, make a certain temperament, maybe melancholic or sanguinic or choleric or something like that. Now, again, this sounds strange, but it's actually pretty similar to what we think if we say our brain physiology is in some way determined by the laws of physics, right? And the brain physiology produces certain kind of hormones and gives us certain character types. We do that in Myers-Briggs or whatever kind of system we use to determine character types. That's basically the same idea, only that we locate these laws on a physical level here now, not in the celestial sphere. And so if you take that as an analog, you can sort of extrapolate and see what Thomas Aquinas would say in the current situation. And what would he say? He would say that he's not the only one to say that the motion of the stars inclines us in a certain direction, you know, by character type or whatever it is. But it doesn't necessitate us. It is not deterministic. Astra inclinant non necessitant. The stars incline, they don't necessitate. And now that would require a bit more discussion, but that's sort of what Thomas Aquinas would say about laws of nature, which are prescriptive. There's a question, you know, whether they can be really that deterministic if indeed our science shows us that. It is similarly self-undermining to what I said about brain science, right? So there is a lot of more discussion needed there, I think, and we can talk about that. So Aquinas thinks that doesn't determine us, but it's interesting, Aquinas is surprisingly pessimistic. So we have free will, but he is surprisingly pessimistic with regard of how and when we are going to use it. He thinks that for the most part, the stars do incline and that our behavior will be predictable. And only the wise man will resist, at least in the long run. And you all know Amazon and Facebook and things like that, you know, that have managed to make us very predictable, statistically predictable. And it works because otherwise people wouldn't advertise on that model, right? How free are we? And we'll talk about AI later, you know, but that has direct impact on the question of free will. If we are that manipulable, how free are we really? Only the wise man will resist, Aquinas says, only the one who is taking a step back and maybe rationally deliberate rather than just going for the clickbait. How free are we still to do that, you know, when the machines have become so clever? And Aquinas is interesting. I mean, he has some his good observations about when we do not freely choose or how we are overcome by these things. And it's when things come our way by surprise, we have no time to liberate, right? And come in a split second and we react somehow. Or if you are stressed, he says, under anxiety or what, you better don't make decisions when you are stressed out. You know? It's not a good idea. Or if we are multitasking, basically, he says, not using that word, but basically that's the idea. And, of course, our machines make us do a lot of multitasking these days. I mean, it undermines our free will. And so there are real threats to free will, even if we have it. Aquinas thinks that even if we are in the state of grace, we cannot avoid all venial sin, unless you have a very special grace. Statistically, eventually, you will go wrong. And that's a question that people discussed already in the 16th, 17th century, Spanish Jesuits, actually. So if statistically, if you have criminal statistics, you know, why can't we have statistics if that's free choice? You know, and if it's a crime, supposedly you did it freely. How is that possible? So if statistically of 1,000 inhabitants of Madrid, one at least commits a mortal sin. Let's say you are number 1,999 haven't committed a mortal sin. Must you commit a mortal sin? No, you don't. It's like a roll of dice, you know. So there's a statistic about what is going to show up, but each roll of the dice is independent. It's not determined by the previous roll of the dice. And so in that case, too, each choice that you make is free and independent, even if the whole can be predicted statistically. So people talk about the collective and the distributive sense. Collectively, you can predict it, but not in the individual case. And so this is not, first of all, something that says we don't have free will. But indeed, you know, it raises some question about how likely it is that we use it in every case. Predictability also, how much more time do I have? I'm getting there, okay. Predictability is also not necessarily an indication that you lack free will. There are certain things that are rational to choose and that you will choose even if you're wise. So, for example, it's predictable that you're going to eat today. Doesn't mean that you eat involuntarily. It's the, if by free choice, you would rationally choose to eat lest you die, unless you are fasting or something like that, or it's Lent. Also, you can train yourself in habitual action. I mentioned, you know, playing tennis or something, or the way you drive to school or to work, right? That actually liberates you. You don't have to deliberate every little step on the way. You can think about larger questions like a wise man, right? And the more you do that, the longer you have lived, the more your life will be governed by habits you have developed by your free choice. Even though you don't deliberate anymore in each case, you may not make all these free choices all the time, it's all governed by your free choice, and you're actually responsible for the kind of person you made yourself in doing that. And that is true for technical skills like driving a car, but it's also true for moral skills, virtues. If Mother Teresa were still alive, I could predict that she's not going to kill me. Or spit at me. Yeah? I spit at her, but she wouldn't do that. So how do I know that? Does that mean she's not free not to do that? No, she has just become a virtuous person, a charitable person, and she did become that freely, and it is an expression of her freedom, and she is actually freer by having the power to do the right thing. And to do the right thing, and this is here where I come full circle, is what makes us happy. That is what leads us to God. And that is what makes us free. That's the free fall by which our freedom and the power of free choice is fulfilled. And nevertheless, it will make us predictable. Predictability is not the same as a lack of free choice. You know? So you have to see that also in a larger perspective. And now I think I am out of time, and maybe that's a good place to stop. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.